This is a Pinball News production.
All right, thank you, Rob. We don't really have a format that we've prepared for this. We thought it would be really fun to get a lot of the Williams guys here to just kind of talk back and forth. There are so many people, so many disciplines that are part of what we did, and you've seen some of the artists, some of the programmers, some of the game designers, and I was hoping we could get people in different areas, and we are dominated by the artists, the game designers, the programmers, but we do have a few people that helped us do our thing, and we've got a really good group here. A lot of people ask, you know, where do you guys get ideas for games? And you, if you look at this stage, this is how they come to us. We know pinballs have drop targets, and all of a sudden I look at this formation, and I'm like, holy cow, three rows of drop targets. That would make a neat feature.
Yes, if you played my game Chief Bank of Flip Galactic Poker Dice last year, I'm way ahead of you on the rows of drop targets.
All right, so I'm not going to dominate this discussion. I've got some slides that will kind of help walk us through if things get slow. We're going to try and do this maybe. I wanted everybody up here in a big mob, but with the logistics, we're going to kind of do this like Jay Leno, so we'll have the guests come up to the couch, one next to the other, as we walk through this. So I'm gonna just start with a couple of general slides. This was... about half of that group up there is in this picture. Starting on the left is Steve Kordak, who everybody knows. I don't know if everybody knows, Steve fell this morning, and he is okay in the hospital right now, but he was supposed to be with us, and he was blown over by the wind. They're taking x-rays, he's resting, and I don't know much more than that. So we're all hoping that Steve's okay. So we have Steve Kordak, John Trudeau, Python Angelo, Barry Ousler, that's Ward Pemberton, Pat Lawler, Dennis, myself, Steve Ritchie, and Greg. And one thing that is unbelievable is how talented and what an amazing thing was going on. And it wasn't all always peace and harmony and lovey-dovey from person to person or group to group, or gang to gang, as George used to call them. But it was an amazing, amazing group of talent under one roof, and I think everybody had a lot of respect for each other. We all enjoyed it. It was really one of the most amazing parts of our careers and our lives. We stay together. I sent out emails, and you know, 20 guys said, yeah, let's get together and do this. And it's just been special. And we, that was 1989. This is actually going to be 2010. This was just in June of this year. We actually, a bunch of the pinball guys get together for lunch periodically. And it's just always a great reunion. And I'm glad to have one here that you guys can be involved in. So my first guest here should be Dennis Nordman, who can anybody recognize Dennis's wife there? Yeah, that, and Dennis, I'm gonna let you come and. And what I really, again, these guys haven't prepared anything, and I haven't prepared a format. So my thought is, he can talk about the pictures, he can take questions, he can tell stories, whatever you want. We'll try and work through everybody for a little bit. I've got two microphones out there. You guys, please jump in when you have an interesting comment or story. And take it away, Dennis.
Thank you. And Larry surprised me with this. I had no idea I'd have to talk today. But that picture was taken during Scared Stiff, and that's Cassandra Peterson in my office. And on the walls in my office, I had made for Demolition Man some scenes for the trade show for Demolition Man. That's what was in the background in that previous picture. Yeah, all that stuff. And that was also used in the Demolition Man sales video, those wall panels, some of those. And then I just stored them in my office, and now they're at home in my basement. Okay, you can go to the next picture. And then that's during Elvira and the Party Monsters. That's when I had a broken leg at the time, thanks to Mark and Steve Ritchie. It wasn't really their fault. It was my fault. So
working on a good game.
And this is a great shot. This is the Williams guys playing Blackwater 100 at the trade show. At the trade show for Blackwater 100. Where was that? In Las Vegas, right, Larry?
It's in New Orleans.
I don't think this was... Anybody remember?
Might have been Reno.
Okay. Could have been anywhere. Who knows? Yeah, at this point, we're two different companies. Blackwater 100 was the last game made at the Bally plant, and after that is when we merged with Williams. So this is before we worked with the Williams guys, and... in this picture, the arm on the left belongs to Ward Pemberton. Then that's Claude Fernandez in the middle. He did, my favorite game of Claude's was Flash Gordon. And then right in front of Claude is Steve Ritchie. Then that's that's Joe Kamenkow. And that's me to the right of Joe watching these. So I was so impressed watching these Williams, great designers, playing my Blackwater 100 pinball game. That was a real thrill for me. In the back, you can see Larry, and that's Pat. Yeah, so here's another shot, and you see Claude, Steve Ritchie, Ed Boone, and Pat Lawler standing in the back. That's Larry down here in the front, and Ward Pemberton on the right there. So that was a cool event. And then this is during the development of Whitewater, and this is part of the design team with Greg Ferris and Mike Boone, who was a programmer, Scott Slomiani, who did the dot matrix display, and Chris Graner, who did the sounds for that game. Yeah, now it's time for Greg. Let him explain this one. Greg? Oh, have Greg join me? Okay. All right. I'm going to hand it off to Greg now.
All right. So that picture there was when we were working on Elvira and the Party Monsters. That's the artwork in progress. It's a little bit set up because when I did that artwork, there was a key line overlay on top of the painting. So I'm actually faking that I'm painting there. But somehow the brush got stuck up my nose. I don't know how that happened. But it might have happened more often than I... Well, anyway. But so that's that. And what else? The art department. What is that? What a mess. Oh, my God. Is that what it looked like?
I got a bunch of these photos from Greg Dunlap, who on that fateful Monday when they sent everybody home, I think it was October 25th, 99, he took his camera around and decided to get a picture of everything. So I have a feeling this is the art department on its last day. And he also got pictures of about half of the people in their offices, which I will run at the end if you guys stay around long enough. So we'll try not to bore you too much. Who's got a question for Greg or Dennis?
Today, Valley, I don't even know what the system was called that ran like Blackwater and Party Animal and all of those. Those games have not usually been represented well at events like this. You rarely see them on the floor, and people don't have any worry about it. A lot of that has to do with the system. But yet the Playfield design was so imaginative. When you were working on those systems, you know, did you ever like sit around wishing that you could be working on like System 11 and stuff like that?
When I was doing Blackwater, I thought exactly that. Yeah, I wish I'd have had the Williams system when I was doing that game.
So has anyone ever asked you Blackwater, Whitewater, unrelated themes, unrelated companies, times?
Next game would have been Dishwater, I think.
Nice.
I just had this water on the brain, I guess. I don't know.
I think we'll give you a minute for a spot for a commercial advertisement here while we've got you up here together.
I'll let Greg do the commercial talking.
All right. Well, if you haven't been on the show floor yet, stop by our booth. We've got a booth with Whoa Nelly Big Juicy Melons, a custom pinball game that we've been working on for about a year now. We actually debuted it about a year ago right here and showed everybody kind of a piecemeal, you know, half-put-together idea. And we didn't know where it was going to go, but after we showed it here, we got a lot of positive feedback, and people gave us the you know impetus to move forward with it just from being here with it. So we have moved forward, and we continue to move forward, and so it's not quite finished yet. The artist has not finished the playfield just yet, and Larry reminded me it's because I don't have a production deadline. There's no production line waiting for me to get done, you know. So that could be part of it, but also a lot of other things going on too. But if you haven't seen it, come on out. We're there. Oh, the slide. Oh, the postcard board. Nobody has seen the postcard board because I still have it. It's actually in a box. It's actually in a box in Wisconsin. Isn't that weird? But what happened was we started the postcard board at Bally, and people would go on vacation in the art department and send the most obtuse postcard we could find back to the art department. And so all of a sudden we had this mini collection going. Well, then other people would come up to visit the art department, and they'd be like, wow, what are all these? And then they'd start laughing because they're very obtuse, some of them obscene, you know, and it was fun. So all of a sudden it grew into this monster that everybody really started to appreciate, and other people from other, you know, even other companies, I think, were sending us postcards, you know. So it became a real fun thing.
Unless somebody has another question, we'll move on. Okay. Actually, you're not done. There's your office. Then you're done.
Oh, yeah. That's another office. Gosh, that doesn't look like my mom. And there's the team. Mark Wayna, Cassandra, Boone. We're all there.
Okay. Jim Sherd, come on down. Okay.
She had a lot of fun. She loved all the risque comments that we wrote for her to say, and she even embellished some herself, as I remember. She was very nice, very easy to work with, and very cooperative and fun. Okay, Jim.
All right, Jim. Jim wore a lot of hats at Williams. He was our cabling guy originally. He dabbled in design, and for probably the longest, Holly ran the Whitewood Lab. And I understand you're pretty much doing the same thing for WMS Gaming right now. And so I just wanted to give Jim a shot, and we'll see if anybody has any questions. Come on, Eddie. Come on up. Join us.
Anyways, that's a pretty messy office there. And, of course, you can see in the corner one of the flip-out trophies that I had won. I actually thank the Expo for getting me into the business and then, you know, continuing my passion.
Jim dabbled in the design path. You were apprenticing with Steve, weren't you? And he wanted to be a game designer, and as Jim was going north, the business was going south, so... So we none of these guys wanted to give Jim their job, but I don't know if you want to talk about, you know, the attempt of trying to get into that and how that worked out.
Yeah, I was working on a playfield which would be able to, if you put a shaker motor on it, the whole playfield would literally shake. It had a little ridge around the whole thing, so it would sit on springs or something. And literally just jiggle if you wanted to jiggle the play field. Another concept would be to automatically level and increase the height of the play field. So as the game went on, the difficulty would increase.
All right. Any comments about making slots versus making pinballs?
Slots is nice, but pinball is a lot more fun. You know, I can't, you know, really say that, you know, slots is, you know, a bad thing. It's just a way where, you know, it's a different company, you know, a different division of the company. And, you know, what we had at at Williams Stowe for pinball. It was a lot of fun, really interesting, and a lot of really great people all the way through from not only the engineers, designers, programmers, but the little people and stuff that were around. The people that were working in the Whitewood lab, the people that were working in the line, in the prototype lab.
Anyone have any questions for Jim?
Yeah. What was the game you were working on with Steve? Did it have a name or?
Not really. It was just a more of just a concept, trying to work something out. No, this would have been in the 97, 98 probably.
97, 98, those good years when we were thriving. All right, Martin.
When did you start at Williams?
I started in 94. And before that, I was with Alvin G.
Mm-hmm. And did you like pinball before you came to the business?
Yes. Actually, this is my 25th year being at Expo.
He started coming when he was 5.
Did you work on the whiteboard for Nova Rovers?
Yes. Actually, pretty much all the whitewoods that came through from, at least 96, or everything after No Fear. Actually, I did the wiring for No Fear, and after that, I started working with, overseeing the Whitewood Lab at that point.
Did you ever think about building your own game after business closed down?
I was more concerned about continue working, so I still had the play field, actually, or at least part of the play field, and I keep on thinking at some point I'd like to get it back up and going again.
Roger.
Yeah, is there a video featuring you playing pinball that people may or may not be aware of? I just wanted to ask that there might be one, like a tutorial of how to play from a very...
Yes, there's actually a tutorial of how to play pinball. I think Roger has the only copy.
Not anymore.
Not on YouTube?
And actually, I don't think I've ever... I remember recording it, but actually never actually seen it. And remembering it was just a horrid thing to do. It was basically...
I have to look for it now. Probably talented player before you really got started into all of it.
Coming soon to YouTube.
Yep.
Thank you, Jim. Tom and Bill. Tom and Bill, come on up. These two guys worked as a game designer and programmers, which is after my own heart. I worked with them, and we did a lot of neat things together. Bill has recently joined our company. He's been with us probably for about 3 years now. We have a small group that makes slot machines for casinos. We're, you know, we can't stop us from making games. And Tom has started his own really interesting business, and I'll give you a minute to make your plug, and then we'll get back to pinball.
Cutting off in a minute.
Software became, you know, kind of boring for me, and after the demise of pinball, and so I finally found something that was more interesting, and that's brewing beer. So I started a company called Figure Eight Brewing in Valparaiso, Indiana, and we're doing really well after opening up in March, and we're looking at expanding already, so that's it.
Hi, I'm Bill Grupp. You may know me from such games as Dirty Harry, Demolition Man, Corvette, and Congo. All right, that's my whole bit. So. You guys awake? No, I started in Williams about 1992. I actually started working in the factory. I was a quality inspector at the end of the line when Adam's Family was being built. And I was lucky enough after about a year and a half of that to start working in the electrical engineering group doing cables. So if you ever look at the cables on Star Trek or Popeye or Judge Dredd, those are all cables that I did. And after that, I was able to get into the software department and worked with Tom and Ted and Larry and lots of other people on all the games that you play. So that's my short history.
And Tom, you were Corvette, Johnny Mnemonic, NBA Fast Break, as well as Pinball 2000. He was the point man for the Pinball 2000 software system. So, I don't know. Right, Bill and Tom worked on Corvette together. Does anybody have any questions? Martin.
What was the most fun you had on what game by doing the program?
I'm going to tell a story if you guys want to talk.
The most fun on working on a game, Corvette was a lot of fun. It was pretty new to all of us. George had a lot of fun in that game. He's cowering in the corner right now. But
time for a Corvette story. George knows the story I'm going to tell, right?
I think
so. Corvette had this really unique mechanism where the engine would shake. And Tom, when he wasn't writing amazing software, liked to tinker with electronics. And it was this remarkable feedback circuit that I still don't understand. But not only could nobody understand what it was or how it worked, but between George and Tom, the way this thing was constructed, it was like, you know, the spark plug that you have to take the engine out of the car to change the spark plug. It was one of those. Certainly. He's not here to... We should all blame Tom because he's the guy that didn't show up. And so we're having some lively discussions about this, and I finally said to Tom when he's, you know, oh, everything's okay, I said, Tom, do you have the gun for the toolbox? And he's like, a gun? You're going to make me shoot it? No, it's for the technician to kill themselves instead of having to replace that mechanism when they find it broken. So, Martin, did someone say they had experience with a Corvette mechanism? Are they working? Are they not working? Do you guys all own guns?
They're still working, but I don't understand how they work.
Okay, I think you need to have a dinner with Tom. Or would you like to explain it to us?
No.
I would have a deal with them.
All right.
Okay, let's have a hand for Tom and Bill. Thank you. And there's Tom in his office, probably it's Pinball 2000 vintage. Is that a Last Day Greg picture?
Could be.
That's where a lot of them are from. Okay, Ray Gay was going to come, but he probably didn't make it. Ray is the second individual there, right there. He worked at Williams Bally Midway for, I bet, 20 years. And Ray was deaf, and half the people didn't even know it. Nicest guy in the world. And he was the guy that laid out printed circuit boards for all the games. And it's one of these remarkable things where he had this skill, which was they made printed circuit boards by putting tape, pieces of colored tape, and taping them down into the pattern that will then get photographically copied. And like almost everything that everybody's doing, everything changed, from this really unique pinhole skill to an electronic system that is handled. He went from the tape to the electronic system magnificently. Nicest guy in the world, very hard worker. He came here last year and gave a seminar with an interpreter And he was going to come today, and he told me he was going to prepare a little speech, so I'm sorry he didn't make it. But nicest guy in the world. Eric, who is his friend, is another deaf man who worked for C.A. Robinson for years repairing boards. And so somehow Ray and Eric connected that they were both very passionate about pinball. They were both deaf, and they have become great friends. It was actually Eric's son that did the interpreting at Ray's seminar last year. And there's Ray. And this was another individual, another great pinball individual. That's Mark Lafredo, a absolutely brilliant, brilliant electrical engineer. He designed the System 11 electronics. He was a new kid coming up in that time frame, which would be about 1986. And he has gone on to design some amazing chips and amazing systems. Eugene Jarvis is sitting in the corner of the front row, who started in pinball also. And Mark and Eugene have made some of the most amazing software-hardware combinations. And Mark worked closely with Ray, and they were good buddies, and they were here last year at that thing. So John Hay was going to be here, and he didn't show up. So we'll move on to Eddie Hicks. Come on, Eddie. Eddie is a mechanical engineer, and he worked on various games, and I'm going to let him list off because I can't remember. And he also... You worked on Congo, right?
Congo. Yeah,
okay. And he also was in our ramping up technologically. We were ramping up towards having an electronic blueprint room where we'd get rid of everything paper and do everything electronically, and the designers could, you know, pull and push and do things. And we kind of turned south in the middle of that. So. We never got the full utilization, but that was Eddie's big project the last few years.
Yeah. I started at Williams in 93, like a couple of the other guys. They were, I used to describe it as 10 times better and 10 times worse than any company I ever worked for. You had amazing stress levels of trying to get product out, trying to make it something people wanted to play. At the same time, make it serviceable and manufacturable, but on the flip side of that, it was like a family, and something that I had never experienced before, like that in a corporate setting, where you know I walk in, I haven't seen these guys, most of them, for over 10 years, and it was yesterday, except for. You know, kids are older and life has changed a little bit. And that was a dynamic that I didn't expect going in. And I didn't really have a hard time wrapping my head around it, but I learned early on that maybe they didn't know what to do with me. I was coming in at just the right time with boards being removed, CAD systems coming in, electronics coming up in the design group. I had an opportunity to engineer a game. I had the opportunity to design a couple of the mechs for the guys. Landed a couple of patents and had a great time.
Right, and Eddie has got his own company now that's doing a lot of engineering solutions, and again, many of them for gaming.
Oh.
In August, I actually joined Right Hand Technologies, which is Mark Lafredo's electronics company. And he is a great guy, and he is brilliant. And again, there's that family feel where, we're like minds, and it's a pretty amazing thing.
It is one thing, as I just can't stress enough how talented this group of people sitting here, and everybody has gone into their own little world with Williams quitting pinball, and they're doing so many amazing things, and it's awesome. It is a testimony to how great our group was, and it's, and looking back, it's kind of sad. Now, back to pinball design thing. Where this was my ultimate drop target bank, but I had this idea that there are two microphones out there. Can you tell that? Those guys, somebody's sitting on them or hiding them or whatever. Actually, I see one on the floor. Okay, there's a second one. I know there is. This is what we call a prototype, okay? We come up with an idea, we build it, we put it together, and then we see how dumb it was or why it doesn't work, and we try to fix it. Okay, and it's, you know, there's only one.
Yeah, the other one got used when your microphone.
I'm holding the second one. There we go. Anyhow, I'd love you guys to you know, chime in and add. You know, you're gonna have to go. Hey, give me the mic.
Okay, I wanna add something.
All right,
something.
Here we go.
And just tell a little bit about Eddie. The designers and the artists and the programmers always get a lot of credit for the games, but these games would be nothing if it wasn't for the mechanical designers, and there's so many of them that have done so many cool things. And I just remember that Eddie was responsible for the turbo unit on Indy 500. I had this wacky idea of maybe it could work, and Eddie actually figured out a way to make it work pretty cool. So I think the engineers deserve a lot more recognition than what they've been getting recently.
All right, any questions for Eddie? Thank you, Dennis. Okay, we have a contingency. Okay. Okay.
Questions?
Yeah. Go ahead, Martin.
You said you worked to design a game. What game did you?
I had started Williams as a mechanical engineer. At that time, it was going from 2D boards to 2D AutoCAD. And not everybody was immediately embracing that idea. And I was charged with making it happen one way or another. And I think eventually everybody felt pretty good about it. That was the first thing. And then I did some mechanical engineering on Convo as a project engineer. And then I moved in to manage the document management effort, which with the inertia that we had toward trying to figure out how to survive at the end, it was probably not timed the best, but it had things continued, I think we would have had a pretty cool technology base to keep going.
All right, thanks again, Eddie. Our next guest when I started at Williams in 1980, Tom Cahill was testing out components. We had a whole group that would bake and shake and shake and bake the components to see what would fail and attempt to try and make games with better parts. And most people know Tom because for probably 15 years he ran our service department. And for a device that has 2,000 parts, you don't want to be the guy responsible for dealing with the Corvette engines that can't be taken out and changed. Okay, we make the fun, and Tom gets the phone call, and he. He was always calm and right there and just a great, great asset to our company. And I don't know if you've got something to say or we can open it up.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I got lots to say. Since Mr. Kordek isn't here, basically I'm the oldest one here, and I saw all these guys come in. Some of them, when they came in, were only like 19 or 20 years old. We got a bunch of kids, and at the time, I was sort of the leader of the sandbox that we had in our group that we had in the engineering department. I came in at the time when we were converting games from mechanical to solid state. There was about six of us that came in to do all this on the electronics. The playfield people were all the designers that stayed there. So when we came over to the building, the factory sort of was looking at the six of us as, we're the ones that are going to put all these people out of work because we're going to make solid state games, and we won't need all these mechanical people with the wiring and all that. And we ended up hiring another 100, 150 people to do the work for what the solid state came up with. So it was a fun time. And my background was working with military equipment and doing reliability environmental testing for F-111, C-5As, Puff the Magic Dragon, little things like that that we had. So anything that we made in pinball, it wasn't going to kill somebody. It wasn't going to hurt somebody. So it was fun, and that's what we made it for. And I had fun working with all the people, and then I ended up doing the service department. I got all the field complaints, and the bottom line of making pinball machines was getting quarters in the cash box. And if the machine broke, it's down. It's shut off, and it may take 2 to 4 hours for a technician to go fix it. So, of course, I was all these designers' worst nightmare because I tried to find how to break their machine before the guy out in the field broke it. I wanted to know what's going to happen. I have to send parts to Germany before they sent their games to them because they wanted to do the same thing that I did. And 40 to 60% of our equipment was sold to Europe. And a lot of the game designers are making games. We're ready to go into production, and they didn't meet their deadlines and their times. So we had problems like that. I used to do the group that had the manuals, and of course, you can't make a manual until the game's done. And theoretically, you don't ship the game until you have the manual done. So engineering ended up getting manuals because we went into a mode of cost reductions. Everybody was conscious about who's going to pay for what. And that was one of the areas that engineering got back. I know they didn't want it, didn't like it, but every day we would go through and see what the problems with the games were. And I always got one of the first six games that were manufactured as the prototypes. It would go out for photo shoot, and then it would come back for me to basically break or find stuck balls or look for things or problems, find glitches in their software. Because as the engineers know, they don't design anything that's going to break. It's all perfect and going to work just fine. But out in the real-life world, operators have to keep that equipment going. And at the time, converting from mechanical to solid state, the whole industry was sort of shook up as to, what's this transistor thing? How come I got a hole burned in the back box instead of just a switch contact fall off or a coil burned up? So it's a matter of doing a lot of extensive testing on that equipment. So when they talk about the Corvette motor, little game called Hyperball had a lot more testing on it with all the guns. I mean, we still call it a pin game because we shot a lot of balls and also a lot of flipper powers. Comparison of the different parts for the industry of whose flipper was the best. It was an ongoing argument with the Bally people and the Williams people as to what flipper it was. And the Williams people all felt it's not a matter of power. We can make more power. It's the feel. How does it push the ball around on the game with a snap? Some of us could sit there and blindfolded and no hearing tell if you were pushing a Williams flipper, a Bally flipper, or a Gottlieb flipper just by the way it felt to you on the play field. And it was something that we took very seriously at the time on the Williams transfer with the Bally stuff, trying to be very organized in the way we integrate both systems. We made one game with the Bally system, and then we converted it over to a generic system, which I'm going to say Mr. DeMar was very instrumental in putting a lot of software into it to make the WPC system. So that was more of what came out of the game design group on the area. The other part of it was I got to work with a lot of the customers on the phone. And regardless of what people thought, our one customer is the distributor. Second customer was the operator. Third customer was the player or home operator. And as a service department, we answered or took questions from anybody that called in. I think in about 1983, 82, we had a little downsizing of the company, and I think we let go maybe 50 to 70% of the company in reorganizing the whole groups together. And then the departments got separated. I ended up with the sales, quality, reliability, parts, and that was all one group. And engineering kept on doing their play fields and board designs. And everything started to become much more improved as we followed the information from customer complaints, turned them into a positive. Engineering group would work with that complaint and solve the problem. And then we got involved with something that not only should Williams do that, the whole industry should do that. So we got a group called Standardization or Industrial Standardization, trying to make, okay, everybody use the same type switch. It didn't go far, but a nice concept. Well, that's about all I have to say, but yeah, we did have the best engineering group in development, and I think we incorporated the Bally group and the Atari group pretty well to come under one roof over the last 25 years. And as far as Ray Gay, he was here longer than I was. He started about 1975 as a drafting person for doing layouts on the stuff.
I have a question there.
Yeah, Firepower was the first electronic with multi-ball, and Black Knight was the first two-level. What kind of quality control things did you have to do when the two of them come out?
For the two play fields and the multi-ball, the biggest one was probably my most fun thing to do was show the engineer the stuck ball mode. And, of course, I would hold my hand on a stuck ball, and that was the biggest thing on play fields because now you no longer had the glass to hold the ball down on a play field. You had about 4 to 6 inches to go from the play field to the second level, which would put the balls into the air. And with multi-ball, you'd have two or three balls hitting each other, causing them to leave the surface of the play field and getting to be a stuck ball. That's why a lot of these little plastic trees, posts and pins and stuff were incorporated after the fact to prevent balls from sticking, because that's a shutdown game. Passed that on to engineering. Larry, I think, came up with the method of if you have a lost ball or stuck ball, let's give them another ball. Let's kick another ball out on the play field. Instead of playing with just four balls or three balls, let it go till it plays with only one ball. Cheat the computer and let the computer do it. Service guy didn't have to go fix the game because back then you had a stuck ball. You put a piece of paper in the coin slot and nobody would play the game. Shut down, back to earnings in the game was number one. So that was the problems with multi-play fields. Yeah.
What was, this is a two-part question. Dennis did Whitewater with this first cardboard model because he couldn't draw three levels and all the people to make the balls. So you had to make a paper model. What was the hardest game to get right from the design, and then what was the cleanest game that had the fewest bugs from your perspective?
I never took that as a thought as to what the hardest game was or anything like that. Again, Hyper Ball would probably been one of the most complicated games because of the auger feed system to take the balls up. Steel ball hitting a piece of wood or steel, we would actually put holes in 2x4s when we would test it with the different coils or the shooting mechanisms. And the noise was absolutely astronomical, just trying to shut the noise down on that. The next one that was hard was, I'm going to say high speed, with regards to radiation for police radios. Not that it was a police game, but the blinking light would set off certain FCC requirements, and we had you wouldn't know it for play wise, but it would interfere with different police force or fire department's equipment. So we had to watch our FCC stuff. So that was something that a lot of people don't even know. We worried about that. So back to environmental reliability.
Yeah, I've got a great thing. There's only a couple of things you need to know about Tom. First of all, he's a great pinball player. Okay, he is a great pinball player. Unless you're a world-class kind of pinball guy, you don't want to mess with him for dollars. That's part one. I learned that real quick when I got to Williams. Part two is...
engineers would like to play me for Cokes. I didn't want the 50 cents or the 40 cents. I'd make them walk all the way to the other end of the building for the Coke. Now, when we first started off, the reason for Cokes is we had a very unique system of... our engineers had it in their contract, or some of them did. One of them would have all the Dr. Pepper that he could possibly drink. And... oh, yeah, we had some funny contracts. Larry was aware of it. We had two people in our company called Millie and Tilly, and they were actually our cooks. And we didn't let the engineering people out of the building because we could feed them for a half an hour. Back in the old days when they went to the dinosaur clubs, it was a four-hour lunch. They would come back drunk, and they lost the rest of the day. So the company charged us $1 a day to stay in the facility, and there would be steak, chicken, spaghetti, and all that, all the pop and ice cream you could eat and drink for that. And then the company had some financial situations. They went on the stock market, and that was taken away as benefits on that. But, yeah, it was fun to play.
Here's the other thing you need to know about Tom. Everybody here being a pinball player, you all know what thumbing a shooter is, right? Everybody here knows what thumbing a shooter is. Tom Cahill is like a living atomic thumb shooter. Okay, we would put our test games at the bottom of engineering, what was called the bottom of the stairs. And I'll never forget, I don't remember whose game it was. It might have been one of Mark's games or something. I don't even remember. Tom, I saw him walk out of his office. He walked up. He would never start to play the game after when he first saw it. He'd walk up, he'd look it over. He got a big smile on his face. He pressed the start button, reached down, and thumbed the ball into whatever was at the other end, and it exploded into a million pieces. And he just smiled and walked back to his office. But that's how you kept the games, you know, out in the field in one piece. But don't ever ask him to thumb a ball.
Yeah. Stuck balls and thumb it or move your plunger. The kids, and that's what they were, didn't know these little tricks. One of the other items that we did that engineering saved us with, legs on pinballs. Nobody in the factory ever heard of kick a leg or something like that, where kids come up and actually just kick the leg and bend it. And that's a trait in Germany to kick them out. They would actually put bars on the bottom of the legs to prevent it from going. And our engineering group worked on that, put heavier metal and gussets in it. It cost a lot of money. I mean, the dies and stuff were like $40,000 or $50,000 to do that. But the factory did it.
Okay, Steve, Pat, when you talked about Tom's pinball playing, it reminded me of a Tom playing story. It was literally the first month I was at Williams. Eugene and Steve Ritchie had just gotten Firepower completed, and as a matter of fact, that when I first walked in, that was it was amazing. I mean, I saw it, you know, before production, and it blew me away. And we would eat lunch in Millie's lunchroom, as Tom describes. And what we call the bottom of the stairs at the end of our life was a room outside of the lunchroom where we would all play pinball after lunch for quarters or Cokes or whatever. And Firepower, the big deal, which was the first multi-ball game. So, you know, you tried and tried and tried, and the big excitement was you got multi-ball and you played multi-ball, and it was crazy. And Tom started this thing, and it really pissed Steve off, where he called it V-ball.
Steve was introducing or showing Mike Stroll, the president of the company, this new concept of the multi-ball feature that they were doing on the game that they designed and put in. So I was playing the game. Steve was sitting there telling Mike Stroll, the president, of here's what's going to happen on this. And I locked up all three balls, and as soon as I released the three balls, I let them all drop down and sit there and run around the room doing the V-ball sign, like when you do your last ball when you win a game. And Steve said, no, you got to play the balls. I just let them drain down, and he just went bananas on that. It was sort of funny.
All right, thank you, Tim. I appreciate it. We're going to move on. All right, again, Steve Kordick's not going to be with us today. This was the last game he worked on was Tic-Tac-Toe. That was a redemption game that we did towards the end. And when Steve retired, Greg Ferris drew this amazing caricature that we all signed and presented to Steve. It's just it was a neat memory and memento. Okay. Who can tell me which one is Cameron? Okay, come on up, Cameron. Cameron did send me that photo. So, anyhow, I talk to people a lot about what I have done, and I've worked 30 years and never for a day wasn't excited about what I was doing or going into work. And it's really a thing that everyone on this panel has. It's called passion. And I've got two little kids, and all I want to try and teach them is, you know, be passionate about things and follow your passion. And I tell Cameron's story to a lot of people. Cameron lived in Australia. And we knew him through this community, which was the pinball collectors that were at the time on, you know, Rec Games Pinball, which at the time before Cameron worked there and he was active on it, a lot of people at Williams really watched and participated.
Sorry. What I said.
And he was a little outspoken and a little immature, but really, really. And nobody on RGP is immature. We know that. And I either at Expo or through email or something, somehow he solicited us. He wants to. He was here.
It was. I started talking to Dwight Sullivan. He had posted to RGP in a thread about Star Trek: Next Generation. And I was, you know, I was a college nerd. I'm certainly not a nerd anymore. But back then, believe it or not, I was a little bit of a nerd. So I sent him an email and I did the whole, hey, Dwight, you know, you probably don't know me. I love all your games, blah, 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 blah. And Dwight, you know, being just the fantastic guy he is, he actually responded, which I wasn't expecting, but he responded. And we just started chatting back and forth. And in one email, I don't even remember the context, but in one email I mentioned how great it would be to work at Williams. And I was being sarcastic. I even think I put in parentheses like, ha ha, like, yeah, like that's ever going to happen. But, you know, email being the sort of emotionless medium that it is, Dwight thought that I was being serious. And in his reply, he said, well, you know, I was talking to the head of our software department, Ted Estes, and he was saying that if you're interested in, you know, why don't you send us your resume? So I thought, all right, it really couldn't hurt. Bear in mind, I was still in college at this time, so I wasn't really expecting much to come of it. But I sent my resume, and I got talking with Ted, and I happened to mention to Ted that I was going to be in the U.S. at the end of that year. I was planning a ski trip in Colorado with some friends. And so Ted said, why don't you come around for an interview? And again, I thought, all right, what can it hurt? You know, I get to see how pinball's made and stuff like that. And in my head, for the whole time, well, for most of the time in my head, I was thinking it was more of a tour than an actual interview. But as it got closer, it began to dawn on me that these people really wanted to interview me for some reason. And so I came, I saw, you know, I was interviewed. I remember talking to Tom and Bill and Larry, of course, and Dwight and several other people there. And it's weird. Like, you meet these guys and it's like, you know, I don't know whether to shake your hands or sort of, you know, like, we're not worthy type of thing. But you know, they're a fan. It's like everyone's saying. I mean, it might sound like a broken record, but they really are a great group, you know, very talented. And once I visited the plant and met them all and saw what they did, you know, I just had to have it. So I pretty much did whatever I could to get the job. And well, my parents call it winning by whining. So I'd been practicing most of my life.
So after the interview, we talk amongst ourselves, and it was pretty much that he was enthusiastic and he was qualified, and he might do good work, he might not, but he lived in Australia and he didn't have a green card. And so it was really an issue of, you know, this is a project. We have to move him from Australia and we have to deal with immigration. And it's something that was done from time to time, but it was really in extraordinary cases, and it's a great time and a great expense to go through that. And he was enthusiastic and he looked good, but he didn't register, you know, to us as superstar. So we said thanks, but no thanks. You know, it just doesn't make sense. And so Cameron asked why, and we told him, and he said, "Well, how about if I just get myself there and I'll deal with the immigration issues?" And we're like, okay.
Were you just calling my bluff? Did you actually think I was going to do it?
I've often wondered that.
We didn't think you were going to do it. However, we were serious and you know, we wanted to hire you, but not at the level that it was originally posted. So he took care of moving himself from Australia to Chicago. He took the responsibility for all the immigration stuff. He came in and was a superstar. He worked on great games, did wonderful work. He's been doing games for, it's probably, what, 15 years now?
Actually, my very first day at Williams was 15 years ago this past Wednesday. So,
And one last word. It's just... I say to everybody, figure out what you're passionate about. Cameron wanted to do this, and he went and did it. And I that's my lesson and moral to everybody. So back to pinball.
Well, I started at Williams, and that photo, and the first game I actually worked on was Tic-a-Tac-Toe with Steve, and here I was. I mean, I was, you know, fresh off the boat, as it were. Literally, I was so fresh out of college that I missed my graduation ceremony because I was already here working. And here I am, weeks later, I'm working with, you know, Steve Kordek. Now, granted, it was just a redemption game, but still, I mean, it was Steve Kordek. I mean, that was unbelievable. And I was pretty much doing the software for that on my own. You know, my office, Ted had sat me across the hall from him, and he offered great support when I needed it. But, you know, every line of code in that game is mine, which I was pretty proud of. You know, the game certainly, I mean, it earned well, but you know, it didn't break any records production wise, but I still have very fond memories of it. People who were here last year may remember Rush and I. That's actually the photo from last year, I think. 2 years ago? 3 years ago? That one's 07? Because Rush and I, we brought... We modified Tic-a-Tac-Toe to dispense gumballs. I remember when I was working on it, I was thinking, you know, this would be really cool, like if you have it at home, to dispense gumballs. So I wrote some code. I didn't have, I had a design in my head for a gumball dispenser, and I wrote some code built into the game. you know, to drive this gumball dispenser. And then 12 years later, Rush and I in his basement built it. Duncan and I built a prototype several years before just to prove the concept. But then we did the whole thing. So the Kahuna Zone. I'm pretty sure that everyone in here knows that the secret code name while we were working on Star Wars was the Big Kahuna. We had to have a code name on it because of Lucas. They were unbelievably paranoid about Episode One and secrets leaking, and apparently, you know, some guys in Chicago would put their entire organization in jeopardy. So they made sure that while we were working on this game, as few people knew about it as possible. So we were all locked away in this special part of engineering that was connected to the art department. And this door was made. The sign on the door was I think a Greg Ferris special. Yeah, and right, and the door had to be mounted, I think, in a steel frame with special tamper-proof hinges or something ridiculous like that. But to get admittance in the door, you had to see Larry and sign the NDA. And so obviously all the people working on the team, on the game, had access, as did Larry and Jim Patler as well. You know, running engineering, you need access to all the games. But one person who did not have access to that door was Neil Nicastro, the CEO. And so one day, one afternoon, we're busy little beavers working away on this game, and my office was sort of on the other side of the wall from where that door was. And so whenever anyone badged in, I could hear the badge reader beep. And so I heard a beep, and someone pushed on the door, and then nothing. And then like 2 or 3 seconds later, another beep, and they pushed on the door, and then another, and then some pounding on the door. And I'm thinking, what's going on here? And so John Papaduk, he gets up and he walks over and he opens the door like this and sticks his head out. He's like, yes. And it's Neil Nicastro standing out there. And you know, good on John. He stood his ground and he did not let him in. He's like, you have to see Larry. We can't let you in. And shut the door. And that's why Neil shut down Pinball. No. But actually, when the door was first installed, I was gunning for one of those little slidey things that you could open and like peek through. But alas, you know, we actually had to make games instead of just playing all the time. So this photo was taken at a Star Wars convention in Denver in May of, I guess that would have been 99, and Jim Patler was there, and Duncan, and in fact Duncan's wearing the same shirt as in that photo.
It's never left my body.
And this show was a sort of last minute decision by us to take the game there. We weren't even on the official list, and Lucas wasn't sure. Well, Williams wasn't sure about showing the game that early because we still had Revenge from Mars was still on the line and up for sale and everything like that. But you know, this game was there for 3 or 4 days at this convention with a line at least 20 minutes long to play it the whole time. And no one mentioned it online, so at least not on RGP, at least where we were looking. So the little kid in the photo is the one who played, Jake Lloyd, who played Anakin in the movie. And the voice of Jar Jar, what was his name? Ahmed Best, yes. The voice of Jar Jar was also there. And they both had done... they both did custom voices for us. They were both there at the show, and they both played and loved the game. So I'll hand it over to Jim here.
Yeah, just continue the broken record about what great people are here. I mean, when you look at the talent and all the talent, you know, of all these different individuals, I think that Cameron's story about John holding his position is just another example of how there's not one person in here who has a strong opinion on anything. So it was always interesting to see how everybody was able to express themselves and still support each other. And it was always a special, one of the best companies I've ever worked for. So when we look at PIN 2000 and the Inner Sanctum, I actually forgot about that. I did remember the Neil story immediately as soon as you started talking about it. But the amount of work that went into it for all the innovations, the flipper buzz, the cabinets, just everything. It was remarkable the way everybody pulled together and made that happen in a very short period of time. So it was fantastic.
There's you, Roger. Can you join us? Thank you. Does anyone have any questions for Cameron or Jim?
I have no idea.
It's a shuffle alley. I think Steve Kordak was working on that.
But this is probably another picture towards the end when everything was getting picked up and deposited and everybody was trying to keep, you know, some type of hands on everything. Anyhow, yeah. Roger was commenting, we don't look like that anymore. My only comment is she probably still does. Yeah. So
that was at the photo shoot, wasn't it?
Oh, go ahead. I'm just looking at the picture, and I have a feeling that that was when we flew out to California with a game that was not really completed.
Oh, that's right.
To meet up with Cassandra and have her, I think, do some speech for us, and the photo shoot for the first brochures for Elvira and the Party Monsters. And I guess the thing that I remember, and it's probably going to be different than what's going through everybody's mind now, was this person kind of walks in, and it's an entourage, and it was a makeup person and whatever else, and Mark Pearson was Cassandra's husband, and he was there for the shoot as well, and we're kind of talking, and I'm wondering where is Cassandra and whatever else, and I guess she had already come through. I didn't even recognize, you know, what she looked like. We'd only talked on the phone and, you know, had her get up and whatever else, but she was really wonderful, a great person to work with, really got it, was totally in the pinball. And the one thing that I remember, Greg, was so is the back glass finished? And it kind of was finished, but there were some little things like I love Smarky and some other things that were put on just to kind of make her feel as part of the project. I mean, one of the things that we tried to do, and I guess I was the biggest proponent for it and maybe a pain in the ass to most people, was allow enough turnaround time for approvals on licensed themes. In this particular instance, I mean, we're out there for a photo shoot, guys. You know, the game is basically done. We had not gone through really kind of like the right procedures for Cassandra to see everything and give her blessing. So in essence, we were going out there and saying, "Hi, we'll get the approval there. It's not really a big deal." It was the first license that I had worked on, so I was still kind of getting the hang of things. And I'll never forget when she came by to look at the back glass and was like, "So this is it?" And it's like, "I think doesn't it look great. Doesn't it look incredible. It's wonderful." And all she wanted to do is add in some extra things. So there wasn't a lot of input from her. But anyway.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, as Roger pointed out, it was the first license he had worked on there. And I would say during the photo shoot, he was nervous for a number of reasons, you know, getting the license signed. And I just remember how the photo shoot was very formal. You know, it's at least started out very formal. And, you know, it's like you could just tell it didn't feel right. You know, the photo shoot, that nobody was having fun. You know, what do you want me to do? You want me to do this? And all of a sudden, Cassandra got the idea of what she could contribute. And the whole photo shoot changed, and it just became a party. And yep. There's so many shots that came out of it. It was just unbelievable.
And so many speech calls as well.
Yep.
That she came up with just improvising. So
it changed the entire tone and made it a great...
Right. That makes me think of, we had a lot of the licenses. Roger handled all of the licenses, and it was an amazing job of dueling Rolodexes to get all the right people and players in place. But talking about how cooperative Cassandra was, there was a whole spectrum of good cooperation, not so good cooperation, great performances, and not so great performances. And I thought maybe you could share some of that with us. Even if we only stick to the happy stuff.
God, that's
Arnold's good.
Yeah, Arnold. All right, so you brought it up. So for T2, I think the best story about T2, and let's see, it was George Petro and Steve Ritchie and myself. We had been talking, at least I had been talking to a fellow that I had worked with for a bit many years earlier, who was the head of merchandising and licensing for Carol Co. And one of the things that we had talked about internally was I had gotten the script for Total Recall. And we were looking at that and thinking maybe we wanted to do something. Ultimately, how many of you guys are here for the first time, or how many of you folks? Wow. Okay. I was going to say that a number of years back, I don't know if there was a game that Joe Kamenkow had brought or if it was just pictures or somebody had of the Total Recall machine that basically was two play fields. So anyway, that situation with the lead time that we needed didn't happen, and we started talking, and the pre-production was just happening on Terminator. And Jim Cameron wasn't willing to release the script, so we had to fly out. I remember talking to Neil and Ken to say, okay, we have this unique opportunity. It's a movie that's coming up. It's going to be Terminator 2, and we want to fly out to California to sit down, read the script, and whatever else. And I won't make this a long story, but my whole situation was we needed to really kind of present ourselves in a good business-like way. And I remember going shopping with Steve Ritchie because he didn't have a suit, and I said, we have to wear suits. I didn't wear my sneakers. I wore shoes and a suit. George wore a suit, and we walked in. And Jim Cameron's first comment was, I thought we were going to meet with game guys. We got three bankers here. But suffice it to say, everything went really smooth. One of the prerequisites that I had basically said had to be was getting cooperation from all the main talent and speech. So the Arnold reference, Arnold Schwarzenegger was supposed to do speech for us, but really didn't want to. And he had just gotten a Learjet and a Hummer or something. I think it was like the first one. So, you know, I'm saying it's going to be $2,500 or your own custom pinball machine. I mean, you know, give me a break. It's not even a comparison to, you know, what he was getting just to participate in the film. And I just remember the situation where we had gotten... Oh, thank you. So Chris is here. Chris can pick up the story because it absolutely totally impacts him in regard to the speech for Terminator.
This pretty much is my favorite story.
This is Chris Graner.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah, this really is absolutely my favorite story. We, of course, we knew exactly what we wanted, and we knew exactly how it was to be delivered. But Arnold needed some persuading, so we needed to produce some kind of a demonstration for Mr. Schwarzenegger to produce the speech script for the game. So what we did was we put out a call to the voiceover talent in the local Chicago area, saying we needed somebody to imitate Arnold playing the Terminator character. So I'm at home in my house in Edgewater Glen. My phone rings. Hello? Hello, this is Arnold. Oh, wow. And he goes on for some time like this. He speaks like Arnold. I'm thinking, oh, it's very impressive. And the call waiting goes off. Hello? Hello, this is Arnold. So I actually had three guys call me within about 5 minutes of putting the call out, and got it was pretty great. One of them was Fred Young. And he was the guy who, you know, of course, you know Fred from many games, both with Williams and with Stern. You know, a wonderful character actor, man of a thousand voices, kind of a goofball. And hope Fred, are you out there? Fred, you getting this? And so what we ended up doing was we ended up having Fred come in and read the script that we had prepared. That was a kind of a basic script. The rules weren't, you know, were far from done at this point, but we had a couple of pages of material, and we had Fred come in and read it, and we're listening to him say, get the extra ball, jackpot, double jackpot, triple jackpot. And we thought to ourselves, is that what it would sound like? It just didn't sound right. There was something, you know, there was something off about it. It was like, couldn't really tell. And so we put this recording together and we sent it off to, you know, via Roger, we sent it off to Arnold. Well, a couple of days later, you know, the word comes back. Not only will Arnold not do it, okay, no one may do it for him. We may not use a sound alike, okay? So he hated it so much that he was like basically going to put the kibosh on the whole idea of having his voice in the game. So this word comes back to engineering, and I'm looking at Steve Ritchie, and I go, do we have a game here? And he goes, no, we don't, you know, without this voice, we don't have a game. We turn to Roger and say, Roger, this is not okay. Back Roger goes.
Back I went, and again, through Jim Cameron, Larry Kazanoff, who was the producer on the project, Danny Simon, who was heading up merchandising and licensing. And the one point that Kristen pointed out was we had never really gotten Arnold a script. And I remember sending out to Danny, this is all that we need. And, you know, I mean, and for his own game, he can add some other stuff because we have the whoop-de-doo and some of the other speech calls that we hadn't really expected or planned on. And the net was that Danny went in and talked to Arnold and in his trailer, and Arnold's reaction, from what I was told, was, if that's all they want, I'll do the damn thing. And they basically did the recording, like, on the spot for all the speech calls along with some extra stuff that
so,
people may or may not have.
So we were prepared to go out there. We were basically sort of standing by saying, get on a plane in 12 hours or something like that. But then they came back and they said, no, we're going to have Lee Orloff, who was the recordist for the movie. We'll just have it done in Arnold's trailer and we'll do it at his convenience and it'll all be fine. So we get the tape back, the digital audio tape back, comes, you know, arrives at the sound department, and the whole sound department is gathered in the studio, and we're listening to this tape, and we hear Lee Orloff doing a better job with the session than I ever would have done. He caught trucks going by, and he's saying, no, go back and do that again. And I'm thinking, wow, there was a truck. Okay, thanks, Lee. So he was great. The recording was fabulous. It was a beautiful recording. And we get to the end, and you're hearing, you know, various people sort of, you know, there's two or three other people in the room, obviously, and finally somebody goes, anything else? And Arnold, you know, the whole time, very flat, just very professional. It's the Terminator, for God's sakes. How hard is it going to be, right? And by the way, it turns out that Fred Young's impression of Arnold doing the Terminator saying, get the extra ball, sounded exactly like what Arnold sounded like. Exactly like it. And the only reason that it shook, that it threw us, was because we didn't know what Arnold was going to sound like. Well, in fact, Fred did a very, very good job, and it kind of got Fred some work with us later. You know, he really was very good. But so somebody said to Arnold, anything else? And he said, yeah. And then completely out of character, he goes, can I say this? Sure I can. Fuck you, asshole. And he said it just like that. He was clearly off character. And I thought to myself, that was meant for me. He said that to me. And you know that it was the first sound call that went in the game. And those of you who have the private stock games, you know that it's there. It was a great moment in pinball.
And my only comment to it was, I remember going into Steve's office, playing the game, the ball drained, and it's like, oh my God. You got no. It's just gonna no. It's you know it's gonna get out in the field. Something's gonna happen. We got to make sure that we take it out. But it was really stunning.
You want to say a few words about this? Huh?
I guess there's a picture up. I'll say a couple of sentences. Muppets Haunted House Adventure, a project that I worked on for Lauren Bromley. It was my approach to bringing back pinball in 2001. It's basically a 1932 Mills official with different scoring features and whatever else as a redemption product. Never made it into the marketplace, but we did get some good test report earnings for a while. So,
okay, we're running a little late. We'll take one question and then we got to keep moving.
Mark Bridgie is looking for a sound call from Indiana Jones, in which Chris Silk. Yes.
He knows that story.
Is this available? The F.N. Jackpot by...
Yeah. John Rhys-Davies? Well, so we did get into a routine, and you may have noticed that we do this stuff in pinball, that we go, jackpot! Double jackpot! Triple jackpot! Bonsai Run, right? Is this how was that how this started, or...?
Yeah, it started
about really, Bonzai! It was that sound call, right? That was me.
Yeah. He is the voice of
of many of those, yes, living in infamy. But John Rhys Davies, who did most of our custom speech for Indiana Jones, did a version of this sort of sequence that every, you know, pinball voiceover talent has now had to do these many years later. And his version of Super Jackpot was fairly spectacular. It was Super Fucking Jackpot! Yes. So we did, again, private stock ROMs, you know.
Yes.
Anyway.
And Merrick, why don't you...
That was a perfect transition over to Mark Ritchie, who might have something to add on that.
Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, everybody. That game was the most fun I ever had making a pinball machine in my life. Absolutely, without a doubt. It was a great time. We had the perfect everything, I guess. A lot of the games I worked on, I didn't have the virtue of having all the top people, which you need. It's not a one-man show by any means. These guys will all attest to that. If they don't, they're liars. But, having that whole group together, everybody on playing that game was perfect on playing. We had some rough spots in the beginning, particularly with the tilting playfield on the left side. That came much later. Playfield came together kind of quick because everybody was so into it. We had so much great material to work with. It was a natural. You don't get opportunities like that every day when you're making games. So that was really fun. I was in the studio when we were recording John Rhys Davies for that particular part you were talking about, and that was just, it was surreal. It was from nowhere. I mean, he just let loose. I mean, it was great. It was a great moment, you know. What else can I say? That was by far the most fun. But that was fun, too.
Do you have any stories or anybody have any questions for Mark?
I'll take some questions, but...
Tell us, right? Tell us. No, don't. We'll take questions.
I saw the sample I did. There was a fish that was put on the back of the cabinet. We're trying to get some backstory on what the fish is for, what it means.
This is a surprise to me. I'm not familiar with this. Maybe it happened after I left, because that was the last game I did at Williams. So that's possible.
I think when Tom wasn't thumbing balls at the bottom of the stairs, he was putting fish in the cabinets. So I suspect that's what happened.
That's really interesting because that's the first time I've heard that, actually.
When you and Steve did the voice call for F-14, did you... there's a whole point in F-14 when you're in multi-ball or when you say shoot this or shoot that and say something about that was fucking close or something like that. Did you guys... Was that actually there? Several people said that they hear it, but it's only on certain occasions when you got four balls going on the playfield and you're not to listen.
That is what you call brilliant editing by Mr. Chris Graner. Because I don't think we ever did that.
It wasn't recorded. It wasn't recorded that way. There were a couple of things that you were able to sort of put together, and Jarvis here also gives some credit for if you throw one call out there and just at the right moment start another one and then start another one right after that, you get it. That was fucking close.
It's great editing, no question. Yes, sir. Got one more.
I wonder how you did come along with Steve, with your working up together with your brother so close. And did it always work? Oh, did sometimes.
We'll talk about this offline. That's okay. We found a way to get along no matter what. Is what we did. It wasn't always the easiest. No, it was horrible, and it was a tremendous challenge for me as a designer. I mean, I set that goal for myself when I came on board there, you know. And I felt like I was the guy who had to be as cool as Steve Ritchie, no matter what.
And this is okay, that it was lots of fun when you developed Indiana Jones and me worked on Star Trek Next Generation. So you both teams were always joking about each other, right?
We actually, that when I was saying earlier how smooth everything went, I mean, that was unbelievable. That was a really smooth time for those guys as well. They were on the other side of the wall doing the same thing we were doing, and it happened.
Yeah.
What's that?
My office is in between both of you.
Yeah. We got along for the most part. Yeah. Was there a hammer hurled through the wall or anything?
I can watch the bullets go through. No, they got along.
Mark, Larry, or the group, how did you guys get assigned to doing the game? Did you put your names in a fishbowl and it's like Mark's doing Indiana Jones or, what was the process?
Where's Roger? It was pretty much, if you wanted to do something, again, to Larry's comment earlier about how passionate you were, you would go to Roger's office and you would knock that door down going, I want that license, whatever it was.
Just knowing, all right, I have an opportunity to get something, Indiana Jones or whatever. And truthfully, dealing with the Lucas people, I remember going back, sitting down with Larry and everybody else, and eventually they understood what the financials were going to be. They had not done licensing before. And we sat down and remember we talked about whether or not we wanted Star Wars. We had a chance for either Star Wars or Indiana Jones. And I remember Mark saying, Indiana Jones, definitely. I mean, the movies are great. There's a lot of cool stuff in there. Star Wars is okay, but it's a little bit dated. And we went with Indiana Jones, and I know that Data East then followed up doing their first Star Wars game. But effectively, it used to be going around the guys when I had something cooking. Pat Lawler, hey, I got Adam's Family. What do you think? I don't know. Maybe yes, maybe no. Here's a script. Here's all the stuff on all the support. And then other times to Mark's point, and I remember one thing classically was, and I know there's Greg Ferris and a few other people would come by. My office used to be in the front of the building. And they wanted Gilligan's Island. And these guys, before and after lunch, would come by, and all I would hear would be the humming of the theme song. And it's like, fine, yes, okay, let me go out and get it. So it was a two-way street, basically.
I just wanted to add, because I heard the question also about who gets on which team and which one is where. And one thing you need to know about people that make games, and this includes all the way up to Mr. Kordek at his last year at Williams, is we are all overgrown kids. Okay, and we sometimes behave not as well as children. Everybody wanted to do what they wanted to do, and everybody had a different method of trying to get into position where they wanted to be. And Steve Ritchie we called him the king. He was the king of working the system and playing the politics. And he was also an incredible motivator. I mean, when people were on Steve's team, and people that hated each other, or people that hated Steve, okay, I mean, they worked harder and did better work on Steve's team, okay, than any time before or after. So there's this giant corral of people that are scheming and planning and teaming and siding and dealing, and I'll do this and for that, and a player to be named later, and it's really, it was a dynamic thing. And to the credit of Ken Fidesna, because he really was the daycare specialist of our group. He would manage all this that was going on and somehow keep us productive and moving together and being being able to do things.
It's true. We were kids, but I think when it came down to it, we also realized that we all had deadlines and we all had respect for one another. When that time came, you knew to stay away from that person or that team because you'd get your head torn off, and when it was time to hit the line, you just kept your distance, and because that's when usually if you're going to have a problem, you're going to see it, because you're going to see it on 100 games. You might look good coming out of the gate at 12 or 15 samples, but then every now and then when you get through 100 of them, you start to see more problems that you didn't see on the first 12. So it's a bad time to talk to your fellow game designer.
All right, I've got to keep it moving. I've still got 5 or 6 people left. I was given a 6 o'clock deadline because Jim Patla has dinner with Jim Patla. If it's okay with Rob, no, there's a dozen people going to dinner with Jim at 6. Are you all here? How many are going to dinner with Jim at 6? 1, 2. Can it be 6:15? Would that be okay? Okay, dinner with Jim at 6 has been moved to 6:15. Okay. John Crutch was supposed to join us. I know you've seen him from time to time and heard about him, and I can't let the slide go by without marveling over the mechanical designs that this man did over the years. I had the fortune of doing 4 games with John and Pat, and I'd like Pat to say a couple of words about John before we move on to the next speaker, if he would.
John, not only did John, I work with John at Williams, but then for the last 10 years, John and I worked together at Pat Lawler Design. John was one of those people, there's an interesting story. Larry and I worked to do the prototype of Banzai Run, and Banzai Run got, it wasn't called Banzai Run, it was called Wrecking Ball, as you all know, or many of you know. We came to Williams to do it internally, and we needed a mechanical engineer on the project. And John at the time was working in incoming inspection. He's a mechanical engineer, but he was working in incoming inspection, and the group upstairs needed a mechanical engineer to work with us. Well, all the other mechanical engineers were either assigned to other game designers, or they took one look at what we were doing and ran as fast and as far as they possibly could from that project. And so they brought John upstairs and put him to work on our project on what was to become Banzai Run. And John took what could have been one of the biggest train wrecks. I think Eugene Jarvis said this to me once, like 20 years ago. I'll never forget this. He walked in and said, "Man, this could have been the biggest train wreck in Williams history." And it could have been. But John was the kind of mechanical engineer who took a look at all of this stuff as a challenge. Which is exactly the same way Larry looked at that kind of project. It was a challenge. And so if you know anything about really great people, when you work with them, if you work with great artists or you work with great engineers or you work with great musicians, it's you challenge them. Okay, you don't just walk in and say, "Do the same old garbage today." You walk up to them and you build them a mountain and say, "Okay, climb it." And the really great people will climb it. And that's what John was. John's the kind of mechanical engineer that looked at everything as a wonderful challenge to build something new. Just real quickly, John probably in his tenure at Williams ended up, I think he told me one time, he ended up with 21 patents on mechanical devices, something like that. Before he got to Williams, before he came to work with us, he was both in the automotive world and the toy world. And oddly enough, he was in something I'm doing now, which is screen printing. And John has 6 patents on screen printing devices, which gives you an example of his versatility and the kind of stuff he did. You know, John's responsible at, on my projects for everything from Banzai Run to Rudy and Funhouse to all the moving toys in Adam's Family. That was all John. I dreamed him up and threw it as a challenge at him, and he built them all. And so he ended up being the head of mechanical engineering for pinball before we closed, and I'm sorry he couldn't be here today.
And, it is amazing how capable he is. Pat would just dream up stuff that were train wrecks, one train wreck after the other. And then John would go build them and make them work. And he's just incredible. Mark pointed out something that wasn't crystal clear about. He often had the B or the C team because the other kids in the sandbox were more adept at manipulating the system to get the better programmer or the better artist or the better mechanical engineer. And the way that Pat and I got John on Wrecking Ball was the same thing. This guy from components, this guy from inspection wants to be a mechanical designer. You know, give him to Pat and Larry. So sometimes those things work out really well, and that was very cool. We all know of Rudy as one of his inventions. So, John Trudeau, could you come on down?
Dr. Flash visits Bedrock. Very good.
Yeah, we had a good time out there. Went to see what they had available for us. We were doing the Flintstones. And we ended up being lucky enough to be there right after they had finished shooting. If we had been there a couple of weeks later, this would have been gone. There were two quarries that were worked on opposite years, and the studio contracted to use the unused one for that year to build the Bedrock town. And we took the design team down there and got to get a good feel for it, for the game, and for the Flintstones themselves. And had a great time. It's Jeff Johnson on the left. He was the lead programmer. Kevin O'Connor was our artist. Roger and me. And we weren't supposed to take pictures. But then they walked away. And out came the camera. Thank you, Roger. And this was done just when we were going to production on Creature from the Black Lagoon, and the Bulls were doing quite well at that time, too. So we staged a little jump shot. The creature model closest to me is the gray one that was actually shot for the hologram. They don't need colors. They need just shades of gray when they were shooting it. And the second one, that it was painted green, I did that just after we had the hologram done. I said, okay, can I paint it now? Yeah, okay. So then I got to paint the other one green. And this was done courtesy of Jim Shellberg and Pen Game Journal. But he had a good time. It was a great. Those were great years at Williams. As you know, my past goes way back to a little company called Game Plan where I started. Went through Gottlieb into Premier and onto Williams, and I spent my last, I think, about 6 years there from about 89 to 95. That was the first big cut in 95, somewhere in there. 96, somewhere there, yeah. And I had a great time. Wish it could have been longer.
You want to really miss it. What you're working on now?
I'm working with a group of individuals in the United Kingdom. And I was over there a couple of years ago to do their show and be their guest speaker. And it was a wonderful time, wonderful people over there. I was approached by this group to ask me if I would like to give them an original design. And I wanted to see how sincere these people were. And they had already done a game. It was called Lex, L-E-X-X. It was a pretty obscure sci-fi show, I guess, on cable. But they had already done a game. And I saw it. It was operational. It wasn't a bad-looking game. But they wanted to do something a little more more ornate, I guess. One with multiple levels and ramps and all kinds of things. And their theme they wanted to use was Forbidden Planet, was the sci-fi from 1956. Great movie. It's a classic piece. So I agreed to do it. I provided them with an original design, and they're in the process of building the Whitewood right now. And it's just a one of, so we're not going to production or anything on this. But we're having fun doing it. eBay, right? It might show up there one of these days. But hopefully we'd like to take it on tour. That's what we want to do, and just take it to the different shows. So I got my hand in it a little bit, but I do have a day job too. Everybody has to. Questions? Yeah, questions, anyone?
I have a quick question.
Yeah, Roger.
Did you do the artwork at one time before you were like designing it?
Gee, let me think about that one. Yeah, when I started at Game Plan, I started literally in the factories and had brought in some artwork samples that I had done on my own, and they wanted me to do artwork for a game, and it ended up being the 10-sample Global Warfare that was the game plan's only venture into a wide-body pinball. And there's 10 of them somewhere, huh, Roger? You have one. I don't know where the other 9 are. But maybe I have a habit for doing those 10 games. I did Crawl, too. There was only 10 of those. They're unique. Anybody else?
This is actually for anybody. There's certain games like Creature and Circus that over time have become more and more collectible and valuable than they even were when, you know, they were first out. Do you and the other designers kind of keep an eye on that? And, you know,
well, I think everybody here takes a certain amount of pride in their work. And if it just keeps getting more popular or maintains its popularity, there's a lot of satisfaction to that. Everybody tries to do the best they can every time out. But sometimes some things come out better than others. Thank you.
Yeah. How are you doing?
Thanks, Larry.
And Creature was one of those games that it was a good game when it came out, but I think it really... people, you know, it became more endearing to people as time went on, and it's really become a popular game for collectors and players alike. This is John Yausi. A lot of you know him, have met him. And what's one thing that's just really cool about this panel, and John Crutch was almost here, but we've got Chris and Pat and John, and I and John Crutch did several games together. Adam's Family and Funhouse are you know, very near and dear to my heart, games that I love and times that I loved when we were all together working on those projects. So it's kind of neat. To have each of these guys here talking about different parts of it. And I guess that's all. That's my commercial, but I love this picture.
Yes. I always used the cheapest models around, which meant my family, you know. So that's my son Charlie up there, and he's 24 now, and forever known as Rudy. Okay, it was his own little following there. I have to back up, though, because Pat, when you guys came to me and talked about Funhouse at the beginning, Python's office was like 2 doors down or something. You had window offices, I think, or you did, I guess. And I was doing a game with Python at the time still. And I remember he said, Yausi, he says, no one will ever play a game that insults him. You have to get away from Lawler's game. No one will buy that game. And he campaigned for the longest time to get me off of that game. But I loved it right away. I wondered what he was talking about, but I got it completely.
Can everybody see in the drawing that
I also remember going down to Dapper's restaurant for lunch. We would always have a meeting. Pat would organize it, and the whole team would meet down there. And Chris Graner would be there. We'd be in this restaurant right off of California. And everybody doing their shtick, you know, I'd be drawing, but Chris would be doing all the voices, you know. You know, we had a good time down there. The first test game, I remember that. Where was that at? Where did we go for that?
Pat, you want to come up here? It's your turn.
Come on up.
Come on up and join us.
That was a barn. Chris left. It's still there, but they don't have any games there anymore.
Chris, come on up. We'll get the team back together.
Yo.
Get the band back together.
Well, this was John's show here. I don't want to.
Everybody knows how much I love the microphones.
Well, the one of the coolest things about this project, and the one guy that's not here besides John that should be, is Ed Boon, because Ed, of course, is the voice of Rudy, and it was really interesting. You know, this is one of the games kind of on the tail end of what I consider to be the halcyon days of the work that we did there. That was an original piece, no licenses, right? This is all our stuff. We thought this all up, you know, Pat's brainchild and the rest of our, you know, basically climbing the mountain that he you know, laid out for us. And it was definitely, you know, there were definitely some dangerous precipices that we traveled past. And, you know, the speech was certainly one of them. Right. Train wreck.
Two days
after this picture was taken, I was called to the bar. It was broken. And I had Rudy's brain scattered all over a bar table because that was the horror show of Rudy's eyelids breaking. We put the first test games out, and the plastic wasn't strong enough in the center of his eyes. And so when he'd blink, they'd actually crack in half. And so here we were on test for 2 days, and we're getting ready to go to production literally like a week later, and we're snapping Rudy's eyelids in half. And wow, yes, train wreck. Absolutely. We dodged a huge bullet on that.
Again, the people who I'll work on these, very, very passionate. You see the champagne there. I mean, this is our baby. This is a big event. So we finally get the thing all done. And this is, you know, the very first night, very first test. And we've actually, we're going to run by another picture of a similar ceremony coming up pretty shortly. Questions? Right here, the young lady.
Why do you think a lot of the machines are more licensed? I mean, you kind of see a theme for more licensed games. Is it easier? I mean, is it easier to design? Is it more attractive?
Oh, no. No.
Let me just finish up this can of worms. That
yeah, you just. I don't work for the other guy anymore, so it's okay for me to say bad things now. It's way harder to do an original theme. Way harder to do an original theme than it is to do a license. And there's a lot of reasons for that. One of them is that you have to dream up the whole world that goes in a game like that, okay? And you don't know where you're going to end up by the time you're done. You know, you've got this wacky concept of this doll that's talking in a game, and he's going to be obnoxious, and, you know, what do you do with, you know, what do you do to make it fun, and you know? Whereas if you start out with a license, you have a framework for what it is you're going to do in the product. And that gives you one good thing. It gives you, when you go to show it to the world, everybody knows what it is immediately. Whereas with something like Funhouse, they have to learn about it. They have to be willing to walk up and figure out what it is you're trying to sell them. Okay. Sadly, you know, and I'll just say this one thing because I could go for an hour. But sadly, in our society, in society, I don't know about around the world, but in the United States, if you're not licensing something to somebody, nobody wants to deal with it anymore. Unless you're Disney or unless you're a big name somebody. Okay, and I consider that sad. Because what that does is that takes away the imagination from people who get to look at new product and see cool new things. Instead, when they're 5 years old, they walk into a store and they better be buying something that has Muppets on it or has this on it or has that on it. And they're trained from the time they're 3 years old to do that. But I don't feel strongly about any of this. Let me just say one more thing about that, and this is really based on, you know, this is the opinions of the sound department and the sound guy, and not should be reflected on the rest of the team. But when a lot of people think of Pat Lawler Games, they think of Addams Family, and they think of Twilight Zone, and they think of the PIN 2000 products, and they think of many of the Stern products that he did. When I think of Pat's games, I think of Funhouse. And I always think, you know, and that really was a game, and Funhouse and Whirlwind and Earthshaker, those were games that came back from a time that pinball was really struggling. And I think that we can really count Pat, amongst the real visionaries that brought pinball back from the brink and built it into the really tremendously halcyon moments that we had from 1991 to 1994. Pretty great time. When I think, you know, when people talk about Mark Ritchie games, they talk about, I'm not sure what other people talk about, but I'll tell you the ones that I think of is I think of Fishtails and I think of Taxi. And those to me are the where Mark pulled together a motley crew of people and put together two fabulous pieces, and you know, unlicensed. And Steve, you think about High Speed, you know, F-14 was clearly inspired by Top Gun, but, you know, there was no license. We just went and made a fighter game, you know, and it was a fabulous piece. This is where we really had our chance to shine, you know, me and the rest of the team, as well as the designers. It was what was exciting about it. It was something that we were contributing that was our thing. And, you know, when we go and do, you know, I mean, I'm very proud of the work that I did for Lord of the Rings, but... And, you know, that might have been my favorite thing ever to do, because I've read that book like 20 times. I mean, I ask me anything. But you know, it was Lord of the Rings. It was, you know, it was somebody else's work. It was, you know, somebody else's tunes. And, you know, we did nice work with it, but it wasn't the tunes that we wrote for Funhouse. It wasn't the tunes that we wrote for Fishtails or Taxi. It's not the same if you don't make it up, you know, from the top. And, you know, that meant a lot to me.
I just want to say one thing. Chris Graner, I think, is one of the, if not the best, composer and sound guy ever to grace the pinball industry. And speaking of original work, I always think of Pinbot as the ultimate sound package, completely original, by Chris Graner. I mean, I'm sure most of you have played Pinbot. If you haven't, you've got to play it. I mean... That sound package is unbelievable.
We're going to have to do a sequel or an update or something. I'd love to have everybody talk and ask questions. We've got three guys left. And after that, I'll stay if anybody else wants. These guys have sat here for 2 hours. So big hand for my buddies. If any of them want to stay after Jim and his group goes, you know, we'll do it. But I'd like to give some time to everybody that came. So, most people know Eugene, Jarvis as a video game legend. He right now, runs Raw Thrills, which is the, largest producer of coin-operated video games, and really one of the only producers of such, as everybody fled the business in the rough times. And Eugene and I were partners and colleagues in a lot of different ways, shapes, and forms. And again, just amazing passion and amazing things. Not everybody is as aware of Eugene's pinball role. And besides being my mentor when I started at Williams in 1980, he programmed games at Atari, he programmed games at Williams, and he was really the sound innovator in the era when Williams went from bells, when everybody went from bells to cool sounds. And the technology that he had to use to make those sounds, it's mind-blowing how nothing it is. It was nothing 20 years ago, and you know, where a picture is, you know, 6 megabytes. Now you take a photo, it's 6 megabytes, and this whole program, I think, was 256 bytes with 128 bytes of RAM or something, and they made sound. So I'm going to let Eugene talk about this.
Well, actually, it was 512 bytes, so it was pretty easy. The
512 meg?
No, 512K. Bytes.
Nowadays, an email is 12K.
Yeah, yes. But it was, it was a crazy time. Tom Cahill was, doing the solid-state conversion, and I was one of those kids in diapers that came in to Williams in 1979, and the sound system was kind of a cool time, because we went from the bells and the chimes, which today I almost, you know, I like, I'm having a second liking of them. You know, maybe I'm just getting Alzheimer's, but I love those old electromechanical sounds. But back in those days, you know, we were the new kids, and that was all, you know, bullshit. And we were bringing in the new era of electronic sounds. And it's funny, the I remember the management always called them gurgles and burps. That's what...
Did you do the Disco Fever talking? No, Disco Fever.
No, I didn't, so...
Okay, that's Paul the Salt Dust.
Yeah.
We showed that at the show. Okay. It's our first talking digital machine.
Right, and that was... Paul worked... with that technology, and it most famous as Gorgar's voice, and there was a record. I don't know if anybody has the vinyl from Gorgar. Oh, right. Okay. it was really cool to you kind of start out with a blank slate. You got a microprocessor. You got 512 bytes, you know, and okay, make, you know, 3 minutes of sound, you know, But we dreamed of all kinds of stuff. There was sine wave generators and square wave generators and frequency modulation and you know. And then Chris kind of ran away with the FM synthesis stuff later on. But it was a really cool pioneering time of sounds and the infamous Williams tilt sound. You know, it's kind of like ooh. I don't know if you guys remember that one. And, you know, just some crazy stuff. But, you know, I had a great time in those early days. I spent about 10 years off and on in pinball and worked with Steve Ritchie, Steve Kordek, and just the whole cast over here. But probably the best thing I ever did was to get this kid, Larry DeMar, from MIT and Bell Labs and somehow convince him to waste his life doing games. And thank God. I'll tell you one last story. The cool thing about Williams was, I don't know if it was that cool, but there was a lot of rats around the factory. I don't know, you know. And I remember when I started there, I always wondered why in the vending machines there was nothing on the bottom three rows, you know. And finally, you know, somebody said, well, you know, the rats eat the bottom three rows. You can't put anything in there, you know. But there was a few late nights, and we did work late. I guess one time Python was taking a shower in the men's lavatory, in the sink. You know, we came in there. It was like a sink for 20 people. You know, like could wash their hands at once. And he was like taking a bath in there one late night. But anyway, that's another story. But there were rats that were, I mean. About the size of a small cat. You would just say, you know, they're about this big, running around the factory at night. It was kind of scary. But out in front, there were the baby rats that would be out by the parking lot, and the really cute little baby rats, and we'd feed them. But every now and then, if you were really lucky, the coolest rat to find was what we would call a flat rat, and. A flat rat was when a rat got run over out in the road and in the summertime, and it kind of was a really nicely preserved pelt. So I one day, you know, I just found it right in the middle of the parking lot, like a perfectly preserved flat rat. So I thought it was going to be kind of funny to put this in one of those inter-office mail envelopes. And I think I forget who was on my shit list. I think I sent it to Ed Boone or Mark Lafredo. I forget who it was, but sent it to him, and I didn't hear anything back. You know, and I was like, excuse me.
Whose name did you put in the front line? Who did you say it was from?
It wasn't me. And I never heard back from them, and I thought, man, you know, you'd think you'd get some kind of response from this, you know. Or some, there would be some thing would go out, you know, some new company memo would come out like, inter-office mail flat rat mailing. You know, due to health regulations, please do not mail flat rats anymore. The weird thing was is that my briefcase, I always carry this briefcase around, if anybody knows. My briefcase started kind of smelling. And, you know, and I didn't know what it was. And it was a couple months later, and I checked on my briefcase finally, and that envelope had somehow gotten back into my briefcase. So, you know, I guess return to sender, you know.
All right, I want George Gomez to come up here and join me. One of the most amazing times in my life was the development of the PIN 2000 project. George and Pat created the vision of putting pinball holograms of images out there on the playfield with the ball. And then... again, an amazingly talented, passionate group. You can read a movie. You can watch a movie about it. So I don't need to go on. Went and did the impossible and did the incredible, and didn't have a happy ending. But was it exhilarating and amazing to see what was accomplished by such a group in such a time? And I think we've got another champagne celebration for the first day of Revenge from Mars here. And here's George Gomez.
Yeah, that was definitely a hard-fought moment that you're experiencing right there. I think that it's difficult to convey to people how you've heard all these guys talking about this incredible group of people and the situation. And Steve Ritchie used to say that, you know, never again in history will this ever occur. This collection of talent in every area, because there was a moment in time in which the video game side was having remarkable success, and the pinball guys were having remarkable success, and it was a really amazing place. It was a place that, where they kind of let us run with the ball. And I think the notion, I've worked at a lot of companies. I worked at a lot of companies before I worked at Williams, and I've worked at a lot of companies since. And I've yet to experience that level of just freedom, just creative freedom. And so all of these amazing products that these guys have been showing you all afternoon and all the stories and stuff come from granting people that level of creative freedom. The passion is clear, and so all that's happening is you're bringing the passion to bear. Pinball 2000 was an amazing moment in time in my life. At that particular moment in time, the company essentially, gave me the keys to the castle and said, here, drive. And everyone, it was this amazing moment of, we had our backs to the wall, we were in the corner, we were like 2 minutes from being on the mat and the guy counting it down, and I think the spirit of the group rose to the occasion, and every day problems got solved, and every day problems got discovered, and from every discipline, I'm a big fan of basically no one of us has all the answers. You know, everybody is dependent on all these people around you. Something somebody says spurs an idea, and that's really clear here. You know, this collection of talent, but the Pinball 2000 project was precisely that. And just the notion that I got to drive it was really cool. That inaugural game was a tremendous experience for me, to see the system come together, to see the thing go from Pat's garage in Marengo all the way to London to the debut at the Museum of Natural History in London, you know, black tie event and, you know, 10-foot ice sculptures and all these people. And, you know, we brought them into the room and it was like people were just awed and blown away. The entire thing was great. That is one little snapshot. I mean, if my face doesn't tell you the story in that photograph, that thing was hard fought. That thing was hard fought. That's the first quarter. That was that arcade just for fun. You know, we did a lot of testing at. And this is... this is the Larry and George show. So, you know, how many we went to London. We did these. What's the name of the show in London? ATE. How many guys did we take to London?
22.
22 guys. Like 22 guys to London, and
we interrupt this speech. As George was talking about this, and Jim didn't get much time up there, and Jim's the guy who rattles off 22, we had 40 guys doing, reinventing every part of that world. I mean, when we do a pinball machine normally, we have all the software and all the devices in a cabinet and an electronic system, and we write a new program, and we make a couple of new devices and put the things together and create art for it. And it's a giant job, and it takes a long time, and it's really hard. Okay, to do Pinball 2000, we reinvented everything in 18 months. And one of the reasons this thing actually ever got even... It was impossible, but one of the reasons it was in the ballpark and actually got done was Jim was the guy watching the 40 guys and watching every discipline and figuring out where we're screwing up, where we're short on time, where we're too expensive, where it's going to break, where it's not going to work, and it goes on. And he, you know, he was the guy that was there just making this all work. And he's kind of an unsung hero in that aspect. He's an amazing designer that you all know his great games. But in that project, he's really an unsung hero because he's the guy that had it all in his head and kept all those plates spinning. And so for the number of guys we took to London, 22 popping out of his head, it's there. I couldn't have told you.
So I have a story about this. Larry had us on a schedule. We were doing demos every so often, and it was like clockwork. These demos ran like every half hour or something. We got up there and did a demo, and Larry and I did a bulk of the demos, and we got home, and my arm was bugging me, and so I went to see a doctor, and he said, "Well, you've got tennis elbow," and I said, "Well, I don't play tennis, and I haven't played tennis in 10 years, and I certainly haven't been playing tennis. So what's this come from?" And he goes, "Well, what exactly have you been doing?" I said, "Well, nothing. I've been working on this pinball game for, you know, the last 18 months of my life. So I don't know what could it possibly be? I wasn't even working out." And then it occurred to me, "Oh yeah. I pulled the playfield out of that thing like 30 times a day for 3 days straight." And you know, we'd pick it up, rip it out of the game, put it on the floor to show people how easy it was to do, and my arm took a beating. you know, it's there, Duncan.
Hey, George. Yeah. Can I just a quick comment? George was doing the demos, and you know, there's a clock up there that showed you how quickly it could be done, and he was just cranking them out. Well, the day after the museum, George didn't show up on time. So I got volunteered. All I can remember is Larry going, "Pally, you got to do it faster. It doesn't look that hot. You got to do it faster." It's like, oh God, where's George?
And literally, the demo was taking an entire playfield out, removing it. We had this vision, and there's a lot of interesting things about Pinball 2000. We had this vision that you'd have 10 Revenge from Marses on your route, and you would have an 11th playfield in your van. And when you had a service problem, rather than trying to fix it, you would pop the old playfield out and put the new playfield in. For any game before or probably after these two Pinball 2000 games, that is a production that nobody would envision. But literally, you need a gun for the other games. But for Pinball 2000, it was a design feature where we were going to allow you to convert the games. You could actually bring a Star Wars playfield and pop it in your Revenge from Mars, and don't get me on the fine print where we needed to work out a couple of things. But we were literally doing a full playfield swap in, I think, a minute. I think we were doing it in 60 seconds. And George, just poor elbow, was able to do that, and Jim was second or two short, I think. All right, questions for George, and then I want to bring Duncan up, and Mark Wayna missed his spot, so I'd like to get him up here too.
With Pinball 2000 playfield glass, how much experimentation was involved?
Oh, you'd be surprised. Pat and I went to the local auto parts store, and we came back with some limo window tint film, and we put it on a piece of standard pinball glass, and voila! That was the very first see-through reflective version of the glass. And so we took that into Williams, and I think it was Jim Palla that actually knew of a transparent silvered mirror screening technology. And so we approached this company, and they did it for us. We did experiment with the density of it, but the very first one was basically the same thing you tint your car windows with. So we did go through. I remember in my office there was a wall with like five different gradients of glass, of tinted glass. And I tried them all and fooled around with making sure that the colors were vibrant and that kind of thing.
All right, thank you, George. Duncan is another programmer. He actually, and another one of these passion guys who wanted to make pinballs so badly, he took a job at the gaming company, figuring if he was building a way, he could get into pinball rather than being 1,000 miles away. Since Williams closed and I started my company, Duncan has been with us since day one. And in addition to being a great programmer, we have a small company. We have six guys in our office day to day. And a small company has a lot of big things that need to be done that are not in your skill set. And I do, management and a little bit of the math. And Scott does art and sound and programming. And Bill does programming. And Mark does art. And Justin does our internet stuff, and Duncan does everything else. Okay, there's literally not a challenge or a thing in any arena that Duncan either doesn't know how to do or won't become proficient with very quickly. So he is a workhorse. He is has that passion, is a tremendous asset for our company. And yes, I'm going to talk about Milkshake Monday. Milkshake Monday is a production of Duncan's, but I will hand the microphone over to Duncan, and we'll go from there.
I actually have a little bit more on the Pinball 2000 glass story, and I may remember some of this wrong, but someone correct me. We had one of the earliest of the real silvered ones that you'd gotten that company to make on the game at the bottom of the stairs, and Lyman Sheets, who tends to play kind of expressively and aggressively sometimes, smacked the glass when the ball didn't go his way, and a big crack and a shard, and there's like a cut on his hand, and apparently the vendor wasn't tempering the glass like we were expecting them to. So it's good that we discovered that there rather than somewhere else where someone might sue us. My story is a little bit like Cameron's. I basically wind my way into Williams, Whined. And again, at the gaming side of things, and fortunately at the time, part of gaming was kind of intermixed with pinball. So I actually wasn't even a building away. I was kind of right there in the same hallway. So basically I got my work done, whatever I had to do, and then spent the rest of my time just trying to, you know, wheedle my way into the pinball group. And then finally, when Pinball 2000 came around, I actually got to work on a game, which was Star Wars Episode One. So my entire pinball career there was one game, but it was fun. And I took a lot of pictures, and I wish I'd gotten some of them for Larry's. That's one of the few of me. I'm not even sure where that came from. Was it?
I assume this is, again, with a lot of these pictures where you see people in their office was Greg Dunlap walking around the last day trying to get his last chance to get everybody's picture of them in their office. And I don't know the story, and I wasn't there. But I'm looking. You look at all the other pictures. Everybody's sitting amongst their office in its, you know, junky splendor. And this office looks like it's packed and ready to go. You know, they said we're closing at 9, and probably by 11 he had everything packed up and got ready for Greg to take that picture.
Actually, it's more interesting than that. We had all been locked in the Kahuna Zone there to make Star Wars Episode One, and then right as we were finishing the game, there was Pinball Expo, and Star Wars Episode One was the game, and we'd all worked real hard. Tom had done the whole, you know, tournament thing where you swipe your card and all the stats come up on the computer, and it was really cool. So then the day after Expo, you know, no more Kahuna Zone. So, you know, the last week, in addition to working on that, I'd been packing. And then early that Monday morning, I moved all my stuff to what was going to be my new office back in the open zone. And around 10 o'clock, we got called to a meeting and told, you're going away. So my stuff was already all packed from that one move. And I just, you know, left the stuff that had to stay and threw the rest of the stuff in my truck and went home. We had a lot of fun on Star Wars. That's Kevin O'Connor and John Papaduke. They were the actors that we filmed over at the Midway green screen to do the lightsaber battle in between rounds there. That was kind of fun.
Duncan does all of our green screen and lighting for our video production now also.
Of course. That was a mask. Was Cameron, do you remember, is that was some really expensive Darth Maul mask we borrowed from somewhere, right, wasn't it?
That was from our license.
Yeah.
They sent us the actual mask used in the movie, and I think what we wanted was like a picture of it or something.
Right, and so we had this incredibly delicate, expensive mask that Kevin O'Connor wore and got whacked in the head, and then we packed it in its special crate and sent it back again. And here we are at Denver. This was kind of interesting. Again, no one, we didn't want anyone to know about these games. We didn't even want, like, some mole at the trucking company to you know, take pictures and post them on RGP. We were being really paranoid. So we wrapped them in black pallet wrap. So all you could tell was they were pinball machines. And we took three of them to the show. We had two of them on display and one complete spare in the back. And we were, was it Pez? I think we were in the Pez booth. Pez had bailed on the show at the last minute, so like Cameron said, we weren't even in the program. But if you went over to the Pez booth, there we were. There's Whirly Ball. That's not my specialty subject there. If you've never played Whirly Ball, here's my description of it. If you've ever been in a two-hour-long car wreck, that's what Whirly Ball is.
All right, Mark, come on up. Mark missed his slot. Mark Wayna. Mark, like Jim Sherd, was in the track to be an up-and-coming next round of designer and didn't totally get there because, as I said, as his career was advancing, the industry was retreating. But Mark did work on quite a few projects. He was with Dennis's team on a few games and was quite a contributor. And I'd like you to share anything you'd like to about that time. I'll try and flash back to your slides. I'm going to do it from down there. My remote's now.
Sorry, I missed my spot earlier. I'm going to go real fast because we're running really, really late. But one thing I wanted to mention before I talk about what I've done is I'm here all weekend. Most of you guys know me from Pinball Expo. I've had a booth here for 20 years. These guys are all not here all weekend, so I encourage you later tonight to talk to these guys about the games that they made. It was so inspiring to work with these guys. It's incredible. And after you speak with them and go home and play your games, you'll know what I'm talking about. I started out working, I've started out as a collector, like a lot of you guys, dreaming about being a pinball designer. And I was working in the IndyCar industry. And I found out that Dennis was working on the Indy 500 game. And I thought, oh, that's perfect. I can get in there and help. And so went ahead and did that. And that turned out great. I actually worked part-time in the evenings. I'd work all day doing IndyCar stuff and then drive an hour and a half down into the city and work until 1, 2 in the morning sometimes with the programmers on Indy 500. Then after that was pretty successful. We did Scared Stiff, which a lot of you guys have Scared Stiffs. We've talked in the other room a lot about it. It was a great time. Cassandra was great to work with. I'm sure you guys covered it earlier, so just stop me if I'm going over stuff that's already been gone over. After that, I was on the Circus Voltaire team just for a few weeks before I was pulled off of that to do a game called Cash Ball, which was actually a pinball playfield that went on top of a slot machine for a gaming company in Las Vegas. I wasn't real thrilled about doing it, but they promised me that all the revenue from making the game would go to the pinball department and it would keep all the people making pinballs employed for a while, which was important to me, so I went ahead and did that. That was reasonably successful. After that, I worked a little bit on some of the platform development with these guys on Pin 2000. And right as Pinball 2000 was just about ready to go out on test, I moved over to the Midway side of the building and started running the test program for all coin-operated titles. And I took care of all the testing on Pin 2000, and there was a ton of testing on Pinball 2000. Stayed with Midway for a little while until they got out of the coin-op business. And that's pretty much my story.
All right, thank you, Mark, and I appreciate your coming. I've got just some assorted stuff.
Everybody out there, how many of you are depicted in the back glass of Champion Pup? How many will admit to being depicted in the back glass? I see people in there that I think are some of you.
I'm pretty sure they're mostly people from the team.
I mean, we're probably as ugly as they are, so.
All right. As I was putting this together, I ran across, when you search pinball on your computer, it comes up with lots of interesting pictures. I've also got some more of Greg Dunlap's photos. Do you guys want me to go through them quickly? Just put up what I've got? You're okay? Did Jim's dinner go? Okay, good. well, I was, you know. Okay. Whirly Ball is up here because we have a group of Expo people that every year get together and play this really fun game. It's not found in many places around the country, but you have 4-on-4 or 5-on-5, two teams driving around bumper cars with lacrosse wickets and then shooting. You can't see it. You can. There's there, that's like basketball height. It's like a backboard with a hole in the center. And it is a really fun team sport, and we get together on Thursday, usually about lunchtime every year, and play it, and we have a lot of fun. And so that's why that was there. I have a bunch of Greg Dunlap's photos of people in their office who weren't able to make it today. Here's Chuck Blyke, electrical engineer. He was there before I started, till the last day, and he's doing doubly work at WMS Gaming still. Dan Forden is an amazing sound guy, a lot of games. Dave Miller was an artist that worked on Pinball 2000. There's Dwight Sullivan, another great programmer. He was at Stern, and I guess he's at WMS now, right? Elaine Johnson, boy, I wish she would have come. She was responsible for all of our bill of materials. She had, of the 2,000 parts in every game, somebody had to put them in a computer somewhere so that they could be ordered and tracked and paid for. And she was brilliant at doing that, but she had this uncanny ability to remember every number of every part without the computer. And, hi, Gary. And it was just magnificent working with her for a very long time. And she went to Midway after Williams closed, and she is now doing her magic at WMS Gaming. Eric Prisby was a sound guy, and he is again still at WMS. Didn't he do Star Wars? Yeah, he was the sound guy in Star Wars. Graham West, another game programmer. Jack Scaling, great mechanical engineer. Mark, do you want to say anything about Jack? Jack.
One of the finest
we ever had. Yeah, Jack did a lot of Mark's mechanical engineering and great engineer. John Papaduke, really, really great designer. There's John and Steve. Karen Tribula worked on our manuals. And it's a big part of the job that has to be done. It's amazing to me now, not only for pinball, but for everything. You don't need to, you know, we used to covet those manuals. I mean, we really, you know, you wanted to have a manual and you kept track of it or you tried to find one. You know, now they're all online. You don't even, you get the manual, you throw it out if they even print one anymore. But Karen was the one that made them all, and she worked closely with all of us a great number of years. There's Lewis, another game programmer. Lyman, I'm sorry Lyman didn't come on the panel. He is one of the best balance and rule makers of the guys out there. And, you know, he programmed Medieval Madness and Monster Bash were his last two games at Williams. Matt Hale was an art guy that came on just for Pinball 2000. Paul Barker was Greg's right-hand man. Is Greg still here? No, but he ran production in the art department. Pete Petrowski, he designed Champion Pub with Dwight Sullivan, and it was another case like, you know, Jim and Mark Wayna wanting to get into design. Pete actually got his chance to make a game after, you know, going the same path. He ran the Whitewood Lab before Jim did. There's Scott Slomiani. He is the guy that did most of the dots on most of the Dot Matrix games, or on a lot of them. And he works for our company now, and he is a brilliant game designer and everything else. He's a one-man wrecking crew. There I am in my office. Greg somehow had that in the group. And I really like that picture. This is my favorite Pinball Expo moment. That's my son Alex winning the Tot division on Terminator 3. And there he is looking at the scoreboard. And you'll also notice that I was still playing in manufacturers. And so who's on top of that? Maybe Lyman or Roger or... We don't know. And then this is my game room. There's a local pinball league that some of the people that come around here play in, and they used to go from arcade to arcade. You know, we'll do it at Gala this week, and we'll do it at Diversions next week. And now, you know, when they went from 8 to 7 to 3 to 1 to no pinball machines, that became not manageable. So they rove like they used to into people's basements that have large collections, probably many of which are in the league. I know Roger is in the league. And we've hosted it at my game room twice. This was one of the league nights. And so I thought I'd throw those pictures in. All right. Right. Okay. Everybody come to Roger's fireside. Roger and Steve Epstein are having the fireside chat about tournaments and leagues. There's Chuck Blake. Come on up, Chuck. good. Come on up. As I flash by, we'll try and get back to it. Chuck is a tremendous electrical engineer that really was designing pinball boards from William's infancy all the way through the ridiculous train wreck. Is that our ongoing theme here? Train wreck idea of what we were doing with Pinball 2000. So I'm going to get your picture up there. You're going to say a few words, and then we're going to get out of here.
Well, I'm glad to be here. I started Williams right shortly after they got away from the electromechanical. And so I joined them in 1978. And I had enjoyed being with them, and that was my first job out of college. And I've been with them ever since. I've gone through many iterations, and as Larry said, all the way up to the demise, which was in 1999. When we did PIN 2000 system. And I've stayed with the organization through Midway, done some work for them. And I'm presently still with them at WMS doing slot machines. So it's been a very fun organization. And I've thoroughly enjoyed it. And I've stayed there since college and never moved on. So it's been a good time. And Larry, if you got any questions, let me know. Sure.
So regarding what you're doing now, but roughly how many, you know, slot machines do you guys pump out a year in different forms?
We roughly do, it depends on how you look at the themes. If you look at different variations on them, we end up doing like 80 themes a year, roughly. But generally, there's about four or five different styles of machinery.
Hey, you weren't responsible for that 40-pin interconnector, were you?
Can I plead the fifth?
The guy who is responsible for the 40-pin interconnector just walked in the room. Mister, your ears would be hurting from this panel's discussion today, all positive things, I might add. That is Ken Fidesna, who walked into the back of the room. And I think it was George that said that one of the reasons this talented group was able to do what they did was because the management decided that we were good enough to sink, swim, succeed, fail, but would probably do our best if kind of left to go create. And it is a near impossible thing in a business environment when you either think that this isn't right or this isn't going to work, to not want to second guess and save the money and save the disasters. But that man knew how to do it, and he let us do our thing, and is really, really has huge responsibility in all the great things that came out of Williams. And that's why he got the big applause. Every last person here adores that man. And the world that he created for us to do what we did. All right, so I think we'll put the microphones down, and if anybody wants to ask any questions, I'm going to stay around, and if anybody else wants to, that would be great. I thank you all for sitting here for 3 hours, and thank you all for listening.